it's Mike McIntyre. You shoveled out yet? Hoping it's just going to melt. You're just going to let it sit there. Oh, man. Just wait until Wednesday. We got more of this stuff coming. It's the January 106th day of January, and it's just not going to end. Welcome to the show. Big news from the weekend and big news from today we got to go over. Democrats in Minnesota go 2 for 3 in making endorsements for Congress this weekend in CD2, CD3. There was little drama as Angie Craig and Dean Phillips respectively got their party backing on the first ballot. But then there was CD8 in Duluth, and there was no endorsement after 10 ballots. The path to victory for any one of the 5 candidates is about as easy to see as the road was during the blizzard that hit during the conventions. Later in the show, we're going to talk with political observer Aaron Brown, who is at the Duluth convention, get his take on what happened and what happens next. And tax day. Yeah, remember that. That's tomorrow. It's the 17th this year. Did you take a deduction for an IRA in 2017? It's not too late. We'll talk retirement tax strategy with a financial expert. But first, what connects Fox News host Sean Hannity and Donald Trump besides their obvious love of each other? They both apparently got legal help from the same person. Joining us to talk about that and some of the other breaking news in Washington, D.C. is Tim Mayer with Talk Media News. Hi, Tim. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. That's exactly right. So the mystery client is Sean Hannity. And I think the story here is, as a journalist, is that Sean's come out and said that, you know, he's basically never paid Cohen, but he had sought legal advice with him dealing with real estate and some other issues. But the fact that, you know, Cohen's in his basically circle of attorneys, he never once ever said, you know, during his broadcast, a disclaimer. You know, when he's supporting Donald Trump, and he's probably the chief national spokesman for Donald Trump on his commentary in his show every single night, but he's never came out and talked and said and acknowledged that, you know, look, you know, Cohen is represents me on a multiple different things that I'm involved with. If he would have said that, there would be no story because he would acknowledge it up front. But at this point, you know, he didn't say it. It really casts a lot of credibility issues with Hannity in his commentary right now. What else is he telling us?
You know, people always I've worked with who work for Fox News always point out that Fox News is separate from Fox commentary. There's some sort of wall there. But does this really pose a problem for the Fox News channel that Hannity?
You know, in Washington, the people that do the news, and some of them are very good, Chris Wallace and others, they're not too happy with the commentary that's been on Fox. They've been frustrated with some of the shows that they've done, from the Seth Rich Wild conspiracy to this overwhelmingly support of Donald Trump, and Donald Trump can do no wrong. So there is a division right now between the news and the commentary, but it does cast a complete cloud on every single thing right now. So it'll be interesting to see today and, you know, tomorrow to see how Fox News actually handles this particular story, because it's really in my terms of, you know, if a journalist, a print journalist or any other journalist did not disclose something like that, it'd be really an ethical question, and your credibility, you certainly would be called into question.
Now, this all came out in a court proceeding that was not supposed to be about Sean Hannity. It was all about Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer. What happened with that today?
Well, Michael Cohen actually had a victory today in the sense that Cohen has been arguing on his attorneys and himself, arguing that his client, attorney privilege of the information that they took. So the judge ruled today that the documents and information that they received will go back to Cohen for review. And Trump's attorneys and Cohen's attorneys are going to both review this to determine what's attorney-client privilege. So that's really a fairly good win for Michael Cohen. You know, the most interesting thing, I think, in this whole thing is Cohen has basically bragged and boasted that, you know, he basically recorded multiple conversations. So the real question is if he had recorded any conversations dealing with Donald Trump, talking about Russians or anything to that, or when, you know, any travels that Cohen may have gone to in terms of Russia, was that recorded? And that's going to be the interesting aspect, whether or not that's going to be released. So far, you know, nobody has, my understanding, nobody has really listened to this information or looked at these documents because they've been ordered not to look at it until this case was heard. And right now, Cohen can chalk this up as a small victory at this point.
So the judge's ruling on that, does that mean that Cohen was acting as Trump's lawyer or just as a fixer? I mean, there's kind of a definition there. Was he really his lawyer now that they're saying that, there's an attorney-client privilege here?
I think they're saying he is a lawyer, but they're not saying exactly all that material is attorney-client privilege. Michael Cohen is under investigation, a criminal investigation for other things that are not necessarily involved with Donald Trump. So, I mean, these are business dealings and other things that he was involved with. So that becomes the question. They have to sort out which is attorney-client privilege and which isn't. And I think in some ways, a lot of people feel this raid was almost, a push in a sense, almost teasing Donald Trump to say, or baiting him to say, go ahead and fire Mueller right now for what he's doing. But Trump has not done that, although there's talk right now on the Hill that Rosenstein may be gone, and Trump may start to look at that. But I think this small victory right now has put a halt on that at this moment.
Depending on what happens in this, there's all sorts of allegations here against Cohen for a lot of different stuff. Is it possible that, prosecutors may come to him and get him to flip and testify against Trump because of, to get off on all those charges?
It's certainly possible that. I mean, this is a tactic that people have used off and on, but Michael Cohen has been a long confidant of Donald Trump. I'm not exactly sure if, Cohen would flip because of his relationship with Donald Trump. It just depends what they have and what they don't have right now. So, I mean, it would be odd to see an attorney all of a sudden flip on their own client. I think that would be almost sent shockwaves around the country. Can you imagine if you were involved in a criminal aspect and you hired an attorney and that attorney flipped on you? That would send shockwaves around a lot of people. Would look like this is really unethical for somebody to do something, for a lawyer to do, but not totally impossible.
Now, Donald Trump has been not out of sight today. He's been out of Washington, D.C. He's been down in Florida, but he was tweeting incessantly about Comey today, the former FBI director who he fired. He is new book, A Higher Loyalty, Truth, Lies, and Leadership, is going to be published tomorrow. He's been doing the book tour. We've seen excerpts. What's the fallout from all of that today?
Well, the fallout is Comey is really pushing this book. The publishers already have ordered another 800,000 copies. This is going to be a New York Times bestseller, definitely. But the fallout right now is that Comey is, basically, it's an interesting thing. Initially, he was hated by the Democrats. Comey is a conservative and he was a Republican, but he's hated for what he did with the Hillary Clinton case. But then something strange happened when he was starting to do an investigation on Donald Trump, and Trump fired him. Democrats basically were very frustrated that all of a sudden they fired the person that they wanted to be fired. I mean, if Hillary was elected, he would have been fired day one. So, and now Comey's basically, he's taken shots, not just at Donald Trump, but he's also taken shots at President Obama, because Obama basically made some sharp criticism in terms of that the email probe that Clinton was under that was basically a nothing burger, and there was nothing there. And Comey thought that was damaging to the Department of Justice and the credibility when Obama did it. So it is also, of course, he's taken shots, terrible shots. I mean, unbelievable shots at the president of the United States in terms of calling him a serial liar, among other things, and said most recently that he thought perhaps there was some Russian, collusion on part of the Trump administration right now. So he's consistently going on every single talk show, and he has left nobody has been unharmed in his way, and so it's interesting. He even had some suggestions and notes about Andy McCabe And so, you know, he thought, you know, some of the things that McCabe did or you know, was not very supportive in terms of when he was in the office. So, and McCabe, I was just going to another episode of this news segment that McCabe himself now finds himself in serious trouble, Mike. He could be facing criminal charges based on the IG report right now. And that's something that they're seriously looking at for. McCabe is being accused of lying to federal agents and lying to the inspector general, among many other things right now.
I want to jump back to one of the things that Comey brought up, which is it exactly. I mean, it's not surprising. It's counter to what Donald Trump has been saying. Donald Trump, you know, has been saying, of course, that this was all a witch hunt. It was triggered by, you know, this false information that was purchased by the Hillary Clinton campaign, the Steele dossier that we hear about. And Comey just point blank said that this was not triggered by that. It was entirely separate from the Steele dossier. How is that? I mean, how does that play?
Well, I think it's playing pretty strong right now. You know, and I think, yeah, Comey obviously has, you can look at him as a disgruntled employee, but he has a sense of very extreme, you know, a lot of people felt he has a high moral ground in this, and he was honest and straightforward on everything that he has done. And I think this is more evidence that suggests that, you know, Trump and many of the Republicans are blasting this dossier as the only piece of evidence. There was multiple other pieces of evidence that the Mueller and the FBI had used in terms of doing wiretaps and so forth. They sort of take, you know, the dossier and as the reason they were able to get all these wiretaps. It really is only affecting one incident, one wiretap. And there was other information used in that. So I think what Comey has said in this is, you know, is going to be packed up by what Mueller presents eventually to the public.
Now, since we last talked, we've had a lot happen. On Friday, Donald Trump ordered the bombing of Syria, missiles, incoming damage allegedly caused to the chemical warfare, you know, making machinery that's there. You know, when we go to war, when we do this type of things, typically Republicans and Democrats stand up behind the president and say, yeah, we're united on these types of actions. Are we seeing that this time around in Washington, D.C.?
There is some there's cautious, you know, support on this. I got to take you back a few months ago when over a year ago when Donald Trump was running for president. He talked about not getting involved in Syria, that he criticized the President Obama for the involvement in Syria. So he's done the complete opposite of what he said he was going to do during the campaign. But Democrats and some many Republicans have supported the military action, particularly when you see those images and those pictures of those children and just the horrific attacks that have happened. But, I mean, it's interesting that, you know, we have several other countries, you know, if we look to the Congo, we look to other places in Africa and what's going on, that we don't get involved. You know, we don't get involved in when they're gang raping children. There's a rape war going on in the Congo. We don't get involved. In Syria, we get involved. And that's probably because of the Russian is teaming up with Syria in terms of doing some of this based on the intelligence reports that have come out. But at the same point, a lot of people are wondering if this is just wagging the dog, that the president is now showing, like, how can he collude with Russia when he just did something against what Russia wanted to get done? And relationship with Russia right now is not good with the United States.
And we got to remember that this all happened after Donald Trump said, yeah, I'm going to leave. And this seemed to be Assad's first reaction was, well, if you're leaving, I'm I'm going to do things. Are people still buying
that? Brings you back to President Trump saying, I'll never, you know, forecast or dictate or tell the enemy what I'm going to do. And then he goes ahead and does it.
Yeah. And mission accomplished at the end of that. he knew what that meant. I mean, he absolutely had to know when he said that what he was invoking and the storm that was going to come after that.
Yeah, and I think those are the two words that we should just eliminate based on when George Bush said that. And it's not mission accomplished because, you know, Syria still has the same regime there. And it's most likely it's going to happen again.
All right. We've been talking with Tim Mayer from Talk Media News. Tim, we got to run on here, but thank you. We will be checking in with you. I'm sure it's going to be a very eventful week in Washington.
You bet. Thank you, Mike.
All right. We're going to take a break here, but when we get back, let's jump into the conventions we had this weekend. We're going to jump into what happened in CD2 and CD3, and then later CD8. Yeah, a lot of stuff happened this weekend besides the snow. That's all next year on the Mike McEntee Show.
Tap Taste and Treasure at Vinaigrette, where we have some warm seasonal recipes all ready to create dynamite meals. Our fig balsamic vinegar pairs perfectly with roasted Brussels sprouts or baked brie. And sweet potatoes are always a winner, but never more than when they're roasted with a drizzle of vinaigrette cinnamon or orange-fused extra virgin olive oil on top. Come in today for more custom-crafted food and cocktail recipes at Vinaigrette, 50th and Xerxes in Minneapolis, and 287 Water Street in downtown Excelsior. Online at vinaigrettemn.com.
Kevin Ross here, inviting you to our brand new store called Ambibuous. What does Ambibuous mean? It means one who enjoys alcoholic beverages of all sorts. Ambibuous is a Minnesota maker's market. Unlike traditional liquor stores, we feature only craft beer, wine, and spirits made here in Minnesota. We are ready to guide your selections, where you can build your own 4 or 6 packs. Find us at 949 Hennepin Avenue East in Northeast Minneapolis or online at ambibuousmn.com.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show here on AM 950. The blizzard did not stop the Democrats this weekend. In CD2, CD3, CD8, they all met and they endorsed, at least in CD2 and CD3. We'll talk about that here for a moment. We'll leave CD8 here just a little bit longer. We'll talk about that in the next segment. But in CD3, it was easy victory for Dean Phillips. He over Adam Jennings. He will be going up against Representative Eric Paulson. That race, not unexpected on how that was going to go. In CD2, it was probably a little bit more of a contest. Angie Craig did get it on the first ballot over Jeff Erdman, and people were pretty darn happy about that. And that was the sound of the delegates chanting Angie Craig's name in Burnsville, where they held the endorsing convention. Jeff Erdman, football coach, was gracious in defeat, noting that as a football coach, he's used to having tough competition.
And at the end of the day, if things don't come up your way, you tip your hat. And so today, right now, I'd like to congratulate Angie Craig on the endorsement for the DFL party and wish her the best of luck.
After the endorsement, I got to talk to Angie Craig about the victory and the campaign ahead.
Well, this is just the start. I mean, Mike, what we've got is energy like I've never seen before. We had almost every delegate show up in a blizzard to come to a congressional district convention. So we know people are looking to change the course of this country, and I'm so excited to receive the DFL endorsement today.
Tell me what's going to be different about 2018 than 2016 in your race against Jason Lewis. Are you changing any of your strategy, tactics, message? What's going to be different?
Well, I tell you, the first thing that's different is there's energy like I've never, ever seen it here in, a decade or two. We've already had 550 brand new volunteers. I told the story earlier today of I've got people who are volunteering for my campaign who are Republican women, and their husbands think they're going to book club to come volunteer for us. So we've never seen anything like this. It's the suburbs are really, just as we saw in New Jersey and Virginia, primed to say we want people in Washington who are going to work for our families. And that's me. I mean, I'm going to focus on two things. One is our values, what we believe in. That's good jobs and the job skills to do to build a middle class in this country. It's how do we make healthcare more affordable and more accessible to people? And it's how do we invest in public education in this country again. And I'm really fired up. I'm ready to go. And I think we're going to get this done.
Many Democrats are talking about if 2018 it flipped Congress, that maybe Donald Trump should be impeached. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's a premature conversation. I mean, there is an ongoing investigation, and I want to see what the results of the investigation are. And, you know, I think we need to get to where we get to with the information. This is too important. This is our democracy we're talking about here. This is American democracy. We need to know the results of the Mueller investigation, and then we need to see where that leads us.
The demeanor of the president, the way he's been carrying himself, has been offensive to a lot of people. Do you put yourself in that category?
Well, you know, I'm not going to comment on the president. Every morning we get up and we find out what else he's tweeted. And look, if this president wants to work with Democrats on, you know, putting together a Clean Dream Act or on infrastructure investments, on making health care more affordable, I'd be happy to sit down and work with him and any other Republican. But right now, I'm focused on what are the right things for the working families of Minnesota, too.
Final questions. Bill may have some, too, here, but just with this race, the top of the ticket is you're top heavy this year with two Senate races. You've got a gubernatorial race. Any thoughts on any of those races, including Tim Pawlenty jumping in for the Republicans right now?
Well, all I'll say is I'm focused on one thing and one thing only, and that's my race here in CD2. What I will tell you is it feels really good to have a little help with turnout this year in Minnesota, with the two Senate races and with the open governor's seat. Remember, 2016, it was awfully lonely. All I had above me was a presidential ballot, and there wasn't a lot of organizing that went on in Minnesota. So I'm really happy to see a crowded race and an energized energized group of progressives around the country. And I believe independents are ready to say we want to change in direction of the country.
Angie Craig, a very energized Angie Craig, looking at a possible blue wave here in 2018 as she runs against Representative Jason Lewis. You can see that entire full interview and also entire video of the convention if you want to watch the entire thing, because we live streamed it over at theuptake.org along with the convention from Duluth, which we'll be talking about here in just a minute. Coincidentally, on Friday, Representative Jason Lewis announced that he will be holding town halls, details to be announced. That's something that he hasn't done in the past while he's been a representative. And Angie Craig says that she's looking forward to debating him whenever he's ready to do so. Well, up next, the scramble in the 8th Congressional District. No endorsement from the DFL, and there will be a DFL primary with four or more candidates. We're going to get the inside scoop, from Aaron Brown, who is at this weekend's convention. That's all next here on the Mike McEntee Show.
Seward Co-op, serving the community for nearly 45 years, invites you to shop their two convenient locations, both offering the strong commitment to local producers and healthy foods you've come to expect. Seward focuses on locally grown and raised products, fair trade, and environmental sustainability. Shop their selection of meats, artisan cheeses, and house-made baked goods. Find Seward at 2823 East Franklin Avenue or the Friendship Store on 38th Street and 3rd Avenue in Minneapolis. More at seward.coop.
This spring, the early bird gets more than the worm. They'll also get triple savings from Standard Heating and Air Conditioning. That's right, you can triple your savings in April when you purchase a new furnace and air conditioner. Go for the HVAC hat trick by saving up to $900 three times. Take advantage of utility rebates, manufacturer rebates, and April savings. April is the only month Standard Heating is offering the HVAC hat trick triple savings, so don't wait. Details at standardheatingdeals.com. Some restrictions apply. Standard Heating and Air Conditioning, the comfort you deserve.
The Spring St. Paul Art Crawl, presented by the St. Paul Art Collective, will be running April 27th, 28th, and 29th. This is a must-do experience that you will love. Over the weekend, you'll have the chance to explore a wide variety of art while touring through local artist studios, lofts, and galleries. Hosting over 350 artists, up for purchase will be paintings, photography, pottery, sculpture, fiber arts, and more. The Art Crawl sprawls over 34 locations. Join the Art Crawl and discover outstanding art for you to own. When you buy local art, you're providing to artists so that they may continue to create the art we love. The Metro Transit is supporting the local art community with free transit passes. Download your pass to ride buses and light rail for free during the Art Crawl. Be sure to get details at the stpaulartcrawl.org. That's the stpaulartcrawl.org.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. There will be a wide-open August DFL primary in Minnesota's 8th Congressional District, an open seat that is very much up for grabs in the swing district. After 10 ballots this weekend, none of the five candidates running could muster the 60% of the votes needed. So, delegates voted for no endorsement. Joining me to talk about what happened and what it all means is our Northern Minnesota political observer, blogger, and radio host, Aaron Brown. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Mike. An exciting weekend.
It sure was. You went to the convention. You didn't think you were going to get there in time, but you got there, and there were still seven more ballots that were being voted on.
I still feel like I got my share of convention watching. Yes, absolutely.
Let's talk about what happened here, because we had five candidates, Leah Pfeiffer, Joe Radinovich, Jason Metza, Kirsten Kennedy, and Michelle Lee, all running. And two of them got knocked out right away because they didn't get many votes. Any surprises
right
there?
No, the thing is, Kirsten Kennedy and Michelle Lee both came in with very little delegate support. So it was widely expected that they would go down after the first ballot due to the drop-off rule and really just not having much. Michelle Lee is, of course, always talked about running in a primary. And Kirsten Kennedy, was probably started with the fewest resources, the smallest political network. And she plays into this in an interesting way. She ended up trying to help Radinovich on the floor, but now she's getting back in the race. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I think Michelle Lee's speech right before the first ballot was probably, arguably, the story of the day, and we can talk about that a bit as we talk about candidates. But anyway, those two went down, and leaving the three other candidates, Pfeiffer, Radinovich, and Metza, in that order. And Metza, of course, also started with a fairly small delegate base, though bigger than I expected. He came in at 20%, and so he missed the drop-off rule. And then after the third, I believe it was the third ballot, he did reach that point and ended up withdrawing from the endorsement fight. But he, too, is planning to run in the primary or had indicated he was. And after playing coy for a little while, did announce he would run in the primary. And that left the rest of the night really doing what we expected. Hey, it's either Pfeiffer or Radinovich, Joe Radinovich. And for seven remaining ballots, up to ballot 10, they fluctuated a little, but for the most part, Leah Pfeiffer started at 45% at the beginning of the day or near there and peaked at 52%, kind of faded back down to the high 40s, led the whole time every ballot. Radinovich accumulated the support of some of the other campaigns through the night, but ended up kind of pegged out in the low 40s. And after 10 ballots, they decided that nobody was going to move. Efforts were made to try to move people. No one wanted to. And they ended up voting for a relative rarity in the 8th District, no endorsement after 10 ballots.
I don't think that's happened since Jim Oberstar was first elected.
Actually, in that race in 1974, it went 30 ballots, and Tony Perpich was endorsed after war of attrition that lasted, a day. And but Oberstar ended up winning the primary, which kind of is a way of looking at this as well. We had an endorsement convention, and even if one of the candidates had been endorsed, we still would have had a primary, and indeed we still do. Now it's just a more crowded primary where, honestly, I could see three or four, who knows, maybe all five candidates have some kind of chance to win, and we don't even know if that's the end of the candidates. There might be another candidate coming in, too.
Now, when this got down to the last couple of candidates, Radinovich and Pfeiffer, was this basically reflecting the split we've seen in the DFL between the environmentalists and those who are for mining jobs? I'm simplifying the issue there, but
yeah,
was this that split that we saw?
That split was in there. Certainly was a major factor. I don't think it was the only split. I don't think it was the only thing. Pfeiffer's problem, despite leading the whole night, was that she had obviously her strength was that her supporters were very enthusiastic for her. and for various reasons, mining one of them, her skepticism about the non-ferrous mining was a landing place for a lot of people who hold that view. I think a lot of other people liked she was an outsider, a very energetic outsider with a unique profile. So a lot of people really liked her. Well, the flip side of that is that her entrance in the race, her challenge of Rick Nolan before he had announced his retirement, created what I would say are a pretty strong group of enemies as well within the DFL structure. And a lot of those folks ended up, unwilling to support her. Because normally you'd think if a candidate reached 52%, looked like nobody was moving, maybe they would just drift towards the first place candidate. She just couldn't get any higher than 52%. And that was just the hardened attitudes of the other people and who were there as delegates. And so nobody could move. So obviously that leads us to our current situation.
Let's talk about Representative Nolan, because he didn't speak to the convention, but he played a role. He endorsed, I believe, Joe Radinovich, and now he's unendorsed him?
So this was part of the drama of the night. I think it was the seventh ballot came out, and right before, after the voting, but before the announcement of the ballot, Rick Nolan, who was not in attendance, he was not in the hall, called in an endorsement, dictated it over the phone to one of Joe Radinovich's campaign staffers, and they made the announcement that Rick Nolan was supporting Joe Radinovich's bid for endorsement. And in a rather strange moment, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey, who was in attendance, was the one to paste the sign up on the wall saying that Joe had been endorsed by Rick Nolan, kind of a surreal moment in 8th District politics. And the next ballot,
clerk will close the roll,
was virtually unchanged. It moved nobody. And in fact, the calls for no endorsement only seemed to grow after that point. Within a couple ballots, that's exactly what happened. So it was an interesting case. I would argue that Rick Nolan probably came in way too late to do any good for Joe Radinovich. And, you know, one of the things about this whole story is the role Nolan has played in it. He was challenged for endorsement by Pfeiffer. And then after precinct caucuses, he gets out of the race. And it plays a role in encouraging three different people to run. He encourages Kirsten Kennedy to run. He encourages his Jason Metza. Of course, Jason's brother is a close staffer of Nolan's, now his press secretary. And then he encourages former campaign manager Joe Radinovich to run. So he gets a lot of people into the race, refuses to endorse him before the fact, and then comes in too late. And then, after it all, says he's really going to think about who he endorses in the primary. So in other words, Radinovich's endorsement had a shelf life that expired 2 hours after it was given, which just further adds a lot of consternation to the whole discussion.
So we end up with no endorsement. Now we are heading towards an August primary. Are all the candidates in? What do we know?
Yeah, right now, Joe Radinovich, Jason Metza, Kirsten Kennedy, and Michelle Lee have all announced firmly that they are going for this race. Leah Pfeiffer is widely expected to run. She's obviously the front, you know, she had the lead throughout the day and would have a rationale for running as well. But she actually announced that she's thinking about, she's reassessing her campaign resources and what she wants to do. And so she's taking a little time after the convention. You know, her strategy was get endorsed, and she was going to abide by the endorsement. I think endorsement was a big part of her strategy. Now she has to rethink how she would approach a primary, though I would still bet on her running, but we'll see, you know, obviously. And that also raises the question in an open primary where, with five candidates running, another candidate could hop into the race and perhaps have an influence in a really crowded primary. You know, someone like State Senator Eric Simonson could jump in this from Duluth. He hasn't said he would, but that's been some of the speculation you hear, that a candidate like that could jump in. And who knows, you know, with 25%, maybe even, you know, 25-30% on the low side of what it might take to win, realistically you probably want 35-40%, but it's a relatively low number to get to. And some people might start thinking about this, especially given the wide open nature of this primary.
Now, August voters, that's a different group of people than go to the caucuses or the people who decide to become delegates.
Absolutely.
Who's got a leg up in this race? I mean, is it going to take money? Is that the main thing here? Name recognition, combination? Who is going to be able to pull off something here and get the endorsement in August?
Right now, you've got not much name recognition for any of these candidates outside of the crew of people who are at that convention hall or regular Democrats or perhaps the listeners of your radio show. Which is I don't want to knock you, Mike, but it's a smaller group of people than who vote in the DFL primary, in the 8th district, and so I think you need enough money to get your name out, to run some ads in the Duluth and Twin Cities markets and introduce yourself to the people, to get some direct mail going, to get some enough of a campaign apparatus to get to the parades and all the different summer campaign events that people do. And so that will require some money. And in that sense, Joe Radinovich, Jason Metza, Joe Radinovich, and to a lesser extent, Leah Pfeiffer, have some advantages in that they've raised at least a little money. Metza, most of all, at $126,000. Radinovich is over $100,000. I think he's in the teens or something, $100,000+, and Leah Pfeiffer just under $100,000. So that's not a lot of money in the context of what's going to be a very expensive race, but it shows that those three might have some kind of leg up. And I really wanted to mention Michelle Lee because she's kind of become this really a dynamic, a wild card in this. She gave a speech that was unlike anything a lot of people had seen before at a convention. It was very passionate. Some people felt she was a little off, but it was a very passionate speech that almost sounded like a total outsider speech. She was running against the special interests of all parties, and it was really a compelling message. And I almost would compare it to the reaction in the hall was either fear or like people were like, wow, can you believe what Michelle Lee did? And it was really what everyone could talk about as the ballots wore on. They said one of the things you take away from this is that Michelle Lee speech. So I don't know if it plays well, that someone could call her crazy. But on the other hand, she sounded almost, I hate to say it, but almost the way that Trump emerged out of the Republican field in 2016. She came with this really outsider message, and if she gets a little bit of money, her being a retired news anchor, you never know in a primary like this. You got to watch for Michelle Lee. And on the other hand, Kirsten Kennedy, who also got kicked out of the race early in the endorsement fight, was a very well-liked campaigner throughout this. So if she picks up some money, again, 25, 30, 35%, could some of these candidates get there? I mean, it's really an interesting dynamic. So I don't think any one candidate can be called the front runner, and that's what makes it so interesting. Somebody will emerge as a front runner, but I don't think we'll know for a while, and maybe not even until the dang election, which makes it so interesting.
On Twitter, the cynics were saying the real winner of this race, this endorsement battle, was Pete Stauber, the Republican, because he's got a clear path. He doesn't face anybody. He's going to be able to run a campaign from now until November, and the Democrats will just have to start all over in August. Your thoughts?
Yeah. I think that there is an advantage to Pete Stauber's situation. He does not risk an unforced error through the summer. He can play it safe, get a nice biographical ad out, raise lots and lots of money, and that'll give him some advantages. But I think this seat, being the way it is, it was a Trump district, kind of volatile, in terms of partisan index. It comes down to how do people in the 8th District feel about the state of the country, their opinion of President Trump. And if there's some negativity there, if there's a Democratic wave that at least partially reaches this district, that's the chance the Democrats have. And if there isn't, if the Democrats have failed, I think if the Democrats fail in messaging in the 8th District, they've probably failed nationwide. And it might not be a situation where a Democrat ever had a chance in that environment. So I would say that, yes, definitely Pete Stauber enjoyed that convention quite a bit, and he will have some advantages. But it really comes down to really the national attitudes and the way people are feeling come next fall, which, as we're learning, is an eternity in politics now. I mean, you and I might be half robots by then in a post-apocalyptic world. We don't know yet, but lots can change very quickly.
Robots. We're speaking with Aaron Brown, who is at Minnesota Brown, not a robot. Last point on this. Here's the wild card in all of this, I think, which is the independent candidate, Sandman, who you would attract the environmental vote if the DFL does not put up somebody that environmentalists say, hey, this is somebody we're going to support. You're still looking at that maybe the deciding factor in this race?
It certainly could be. You know, any environment where the Democrats fail to generate a lot of enthusiasm for a new direction for the country is one in which either an environmental friendly DFLer could send more conservative Iron Range votes to Pete Stauber over the mining issue, or a more mining friendly DFLer could send environmental votes to Skip Sandman and knock down the total margin of victory for Democrats to the point where Stauber wins. If it's close, obviously Sandman's a huge factor, and he's going to do probably at least 4 to 5% just standing up. I don't feel there's any way he gets below that just because of the nature of the far left of the party. In fact, the far left, I think, can safely be said is out of the party at this point. If you watch the presidential race from last time and things like that, there's just people who are very upset. And so knowing that, you know, a close race, obviously that's a huge factor. But I think Democrats are hoping that there's a wave. And if there's a wave, somebody's going to come out of this thing a survivor and have a miraculous political story to tell. But that's what the Democrats need at this point.
We've been speaking with Aaron Brown from MinnesotaBrown.com. That's where you can find his writing. And Aaron, I suspect we will be talking several more times between now and August.
I've talked to you, I think, more than several of my relatives in the last few weeks. So we're getting close, Mike. I appreciate it.
I hope the conversations are enjoyed. So,
yeah, I do. I like them a lot, and I hope people find value in them.
All right, Aaron, thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Now, we recorded our conversation with Aaron earlier today. Late today, Leah Pfeiffer said that she would take up to 2 weeks to decide if she was going to run in the primary. So stay tuned. Tax day is tomorrow. And if you're like me and you get down to the IRA portion of the 1040 tax form and go, oops, the good news is you still have some time to get something done. Up next, we'll talk about what you can do still about 2017 with the retirement, with a financial expert, I should say. Also, some breaking news on the Trump-Cohen case that just came out. We'll cover that all next year on The Mike McEntee Show.
It's time for spring cleaning. Wait, you weren't planning on getting your carpets cleaned this spring? Getting your carpets cleaned is not just about how your home looks. It's about your family's health with all the bacteria and allergens building up. That's why Zero Res uses their patented empowered water so you get a healthy and clean home without soapy, crunchy, dirt-attracting residue. This month, get 3 rooms Zero Resified starting at $139. Plus, this month, save $50 when you get your air ducts Zero Res clean. Call 952-ZERO-RES or visit ZeroResMN.com. Zero Res, spelled backward or forward, it spells the same.
Hi, Matt McNeil for Rudy Luther Toyota. My first Toyota love was the RAV4 back in 1998. When I was traveling in February, I needed a rental car, and I jumped at the opportunity to drive one again. The RAV4 is fantastic with all the bells and whistles you need, and it has all the modern safety features to keep us safe, comfort as we vacationed. It fit all five of us and our luggage with ease. I was able to revisit my first love. Now, you can fall in love for yourself by test driving a RAV4 today at Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169.
Hi, I'm Damian Strange, Executive Director of Northeast Minneapolis Arts Association, NEMA, and I'm personally inviting you to Arterworld May 18th through the 20th. View artwork of over 650 artists in every medium at more than 50 locations throughout Northeast Minneapolis, including studio buildings, art galleries, homes, storefronts, and local businesses. The Artist Open Studio Tour may include demonstrations, mini workshops, installations, and special exhibitions. Studio tours offer a great opportunity to ask questions, discuss techniques, experience art firsthand, and purchase unique artwork directly from artists. Arterworld gives you a unique opportunity to meet the artists who make our community so vibrant and invest in our art community by purchasing artwork that you connect with. For more information, go to NEMAA.org. That's NEMA.org. Looking forward to seeing you at Arterworld.
Welcome back to the Mike McIntosh Show. Tax deadline day is fast approaching. April 17th is going to be here soon. And if you're like a lot of people, you probably wait until the last minute. And if you're like me, you get down to that line that asks you if you made a contribution to your IRA for 2017 and panic a bit because you haven't. Well, don't fret. There's still time. Joining me to talk about retirement taxes and IRAs is Melissa Ridolfi. She's the Vice President of Retirement and College Leadership for Fidelity Investment. Melissa, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you on here. So what do you do about people like me who get down to that line and go, oh gosh, I haven't done anything all year?
Well, you're not alone. Financial procrastination is definitely prevalent, and it's no different than procrastinating with other things in life. People are busy. Fidelity recently conducted a procrastination study that found one-third of people neglect their finances, and nearly two-thirds admit their financial procrastination has actually cost them money. IRA investors are no different. So remember the deadline. It's April 17th. That's the same deadline for your taxes as it is to make a contribution to your IRA for the 2017 tax year. And unlike your taxes, though, you can't file for an extension when it comes to saving for your retirement.
So you got to do this. I mean, what I ended up doing is I just kind of dumped it off into an account that's going to eventually start putting it into the stock market because I do dollar cost averaging. People are worried about the stock market going up and down. Is that a good strategy to do something like I just did, or is there a better way of doing this?
That is a good strategy. The market has been a little volatile lately, but you don't want to let short-term volatility distract you from contributing to your long-term goal of saving for retirement. Saving regularly is the most important thing when it comes to building your retirement nest egg. Don't get me wrong, market appreciation helps, but consistently saving is the key. We do find people try to time the market. We don't suggest that because even if you miss a few of the best days, it could have a lingering effect on your portfolio. So focus on getting the money in, which is what you did, which is great. You can always leave that money in cash or a money market and invest them later, or as you're doing, dollar cost average it into the market when you're more comfortable.
People are always worried about risk. I mean, whether it is the timing of the market or whatever it may be with that. How do you deal with people who are worried about risk? How much risk can people take? Is there a rule that you kind of apply on something like this?
Well, it's definitely an individual thing. The biggest thing for folks is to be comfortable with their own investments. So if you're nervous when the market goes down, you may not be in the right investments. Your time horizon, your goals, and your tolerance for risk are key factors to help you ensure that you have an investing strategy that works for you personally. And you really need to keep perspective. Downturns are definitely normal and hopefully are short-lived.
So IRAs, there's two types of them. There's Roth and traditional. How do I know which one it should work for me? Should I use them both? Can I use them both?
You can use them both, but it all comes down to your income level and your tax rate. Let me talk a little bit about some of the similarities. Both IRAs offer tax advantages, and the contribution limits are the same for 2017. That's $5,500. We are seeing more and more people open Roth IRAs, and the main benefit of a Roth is the potential for tax-free growth and tax-free withdrawals in retirement. However, the Roth does have income limits, and you need to make sure your income is below those thresholds. But each situation here is different as well, or each individual situation. The important thing for folks to remember, if you have earned income, you qualify for one or the other, and we have tools available online to help you determine which IRA is best for you.
Now, I do an IRA because that's what I can do. I don't have a 401k, but some folks do have a 401k. They're lucky enough to get maybe some matching money from their employer. Can you do both? Can you do both an IRA and a 401k?
You can absolutely do both, and you can, in fact, you should be investing in both your 401k and your IRA. As a rule of thumb, Fidelity recommends contributing to your 401k first to get the company match on that money. If you don't invest to the company match, it's like leaving free money on the table. Once you max out your 401k, then you should consider putting money into your IRA, and that's due to the tax advantages there as well. Fidelity recommends aiming to save 15% of your income annually for your retirement, and that would include the company match also.
Now, when you get to be an older person like me, the government lets you put a little bit more away in the IRA, I think an extra $1,000 or $1,500. Should I be doing that? Should I be maxing that out if that's my only tax deferred savings that I can do?
Absolutely. It is an extra $1,000. So people that are over 50 can contribute up to $6,500. So again, the more savings that you can get in and get that savings to grow, that's really the key to ensure or to make sure you have a good retirement.
Now, we started talking about how I kind of got down to that line and panicked and said, oops, I haven't done anything this year. Is there a way to make this easier? Is there a way so that when you get to your tax forms, you just go, I already got that taken care of?
There's a couple, again, you don't want to procrastinate, but there's a couple of things you can do to make it easier. First, use mobile check deposits. This way you can make your contribution from the comfort of your own home. Fidelity is seeing a surge in mobile check deposits this year. We're also seeing a lot of people set up automatic contributions. This would be a kind of a regular contribution into your account. It eases the stress of making that one large deposit by the April deadline. And then if you do file your taxes early and get a tax refund early, you could consider contributing part or all of that to your IRA as well.
All right. Well, Melissa Ridolfi with Fidelity Investments, I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much.
And breaking news, a federal judge has ruled against Donald Trump. Prosecutors can review material seized from his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. More on that at news at the top of the hour. I'm Mike McEntee. We'll see you tomorrow.